You're listening to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. I have a great story to share with you today about a really exciting event coming up this summer. An organization called the Society of Creation has formed and is offering a conference this summer. They offered one last summer and excited about the conference they're offering this summer. We're going to talk with one of the co-founders of the Society today and the presenters as well for the conference. Hope you can stick around for the whole conversation here on Faith and Family. I want to say thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting this program. You can find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin on our website, kfuo.org, and look for the sponsor section there on our website. You can find more information about Concordia University, Wisconsin. Joining me by phone now, the Reverend Dr. Joel Heck, professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, and co-founder of the Society of Creation. Dr. Heck, welcome to Faith and Family.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us from Concordia, Texas. How are things at Concordia University this week?
Well, they're kind of quiet. Last Saturday was our commencement exercise for the spring, and even though the school year ends relatively early, there's some activity going on right now in summer school around the corner. Summer faculty workshops and the like are happening this week, so there's a fair amount going on, even though we have a lull between the spring semester and the summer school events.
It's hard to think of summer school already. It's still kind of cool here in Missouri. Well, tell us a little bit about the history of the Society of Creation. You're a co-founder of the Society of Creation. Why the need for a Society of Creation?
Yes, it seems to me and my co-founder, Gary Locklear from Concordia University, Wisconsin, that there is an erosion in our society on the doctrine of creation. There, people put down those who understand the early chapters of Genesis to be reliable history, straightforward history. And so that's happening in our culture, and it's influencing people in the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod as well. And so there are those in the LCMS who go along with what our culture is offering, that the Darwinian explanation of the origins of the universe is the correct explanation. So we think that we'd like to offer a positive message, one that goes all the way back to Martin Luther, who himself taught that the universe was created in 6 days, and he was a young earth creationist, so we think it's very Lutheran that we're offering this message, and we're simply going back to a solid biblical as well as, I believe, a scientific foundation for explanations on origins of the universe, origins of various forms of life, and origins of mankind himself.
Why is this an important topic for educators and for parents? You know, why is this important in education and academics?
Well, I think that who you are and where you come from, where your roots are, says an awful lot about where you're going throughout life. It's important to understand our roots, to have our self-concept rooted in the image of God as well as in the gospel of Jesus Christ. So we have two really crucial teachings in Scripture: to be created in the image of God, which is one of the most important teachings of Genesis 1 and 2, but also to know that we're redeemed by Jesus Christ, who is the second Adam. So that whole St. Paul theology in the book of Romans, for instance, and elsewhere, is rooted in a straightforward understanding of the early chapters of Genesis. So as in Christ, as in Adam all die, so in Christ shall all be made alive. There's a correlation between the first Adam and the second Adam that Scripture itself teaches. So I think to the extent that we understand the early chapters of Genesis in a logical, natural, historical manner, that's the extent to which all of Scripture opens up to us.
So the society formed, when did you form the Society of Creation?
We formed it in 2011, 5 years ago, so we're just about 5 years old. And it was originally intended to be a society for educators in the Concordia University system. We've since broadened it. We still have a category of membership which has more than 50 LCMS or CUS members among the full-time faculty of the 10 universities, or 9, I suppose you ought to say, because Concordia University Ann Arbor is a part of Concordia University Wisconsin now. So among the 9 universities, we have more than 50 members who are officially part of the membership of the society. But we have over 150 members overall. We accept members from all faith traditions, all denominations, even though our a special focus is within the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
So are many of those professors from theology or other disciplines?
They're from all different kinds of disciplines. And in fact, our membership list, our public membership list, we have a few that want to be confidential. Our public membership list does appear on our website. So if people go to our website for the conference, they will see a conferences link and they'll see a membership link. And as you scroll down in the membership link, you come to CUS membership, and it will list Locklear and myself first. Since we're the co-founders, we are among the early members of the society. And then you just scroll down, you'll see the various faculty members from the various Concordias. You can see where they're from, what they teach, all different kinds of disciplines, from theology to science to education to computer science to accounting to nursing, all over the board we are. So we're all listed publicly there, and we have over 150 members throughout the United States, but in particular a little over 50 members who are professors at one of the Concordia universities.
So have you been hosting conferences since the society formed in 2011?
That was one of our initial goals, to host conferences. I'm personally the founder of a lecture series at my institution, Concordia University, Texas. We've done this for 9 years now, and we've had various people come and speak about different aspects of the creation-evolution debate, always from a creationary perspective. But our first conference was held in 2013, so this will be our fourth annual conference. And our topic this year is on human origins. So we're going to take a look at or talk about Adam and Eve and the biblical teaching about Adam and Eve and how that is supported by science. The conference does focus more on science than on the biblical foundation, because that's where most of the attack is coming from, is from the sciences.
Tell us about last year's conference or previous conferences, some of the topics that you've addressed.
Okay. There are 4 broad areas when it comes to origins. And so we have, with these 4 conferences, this being the 4th of them, we'll have covered all 4 areas. So we've talked about the origin of the universe. That was the first conference, with a special focus on astronomy and the vast distances of outer space and how that can coincide with an Earth that is thousands of years old rather than billions of years. Then the next year, we talked about the origin of life, and especially focused on the complexity of human DNA and the massive complexity that used to be described, much of it as junk DNA, but now scientists no longer believe that. Creationists always thought that all of our DNA had functionality, and it's turning out that the more we study our DNA, the more functions are being determined. And so now even secular scientists are saying, some of them are grudgingly admitted, that 60 to 80% or more, perhaps even 100% of our DNA has functionality, codes for proteins, as well as serving as switches to turn certain features on and off and so on. So that was 2014. Last year was dinosaurs. That was our focus. So the origin of diverse forms of life. So first the origin of the universe, then the origin of life per se, then the origin of various forms of life. And dinosaurs are really fascinating to everybody, both in the biblical or Christian world and in the secular world. I mean, kids love dinosaurs. They don't realize, however, that that has been a vehicle for evolutionary thinking being spread, with the assumption that dinosaurs that perhaps came on the scene 250 million years ago, so it supports, generally it supports the evolutionary time scheme for the age of the Earth. But then they say that dinosaurs went extinct about 65 million years ago. Well, interestingly, every dinosaur find where dinosaur remains have been subjected to carbon-14 dating have shown collagen or other soft material present in the remains. And secular science has demonstrated, and this is their own methodology, that soft tissue, collagen in particular, has a maximum shelf life of 900,000 years. So if we actually find collagen in dinosaur remains, that there's not the remotest possibility that they can be as old as 65 million years, which is what they have to be if the typical secular Darwinian understanding of the age of the universe is true. So we had presentations from people that are doing firsthand research on these dinosaur remains, and made presentations at last year's conference. The first two, by the way, were at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and the next one last year was at Concordia University, Ann Arbor, streamed live back to the Mequon campus. This year, for our Origin of Mankind conference, which is the fourth in a series of four, Concordia University St. Paul is hosting us, and then we are live streaming the conference back to three other Concordia campuses, the ones in Mequon, Ann Arbor, and Austin, Texas, where I am here at present. So our theme is Adam and Eve, Myth or Reality, and we've got a couple of creationist speakers coming in. We always have two keynote speakers. One of them, Dr. David Menton, who has been associated until his retirement with Washington University School of Medicine, is a Missouri Synod Lutheran, and he's going to be talking about the origin of man from a scientific perspective and debunk some of the myths about some of the fossils that are supposed to be prehistoric ape-like creatures that are ancestors of mankind. And also Dr. Robert Carter, who has a PhD in marine biology, who has done a great deal of work on the technical aspects of the human genome as well as other animal genomes, and is going to, in some ways, follow up on the 2014 conference, but also apply this to human origins. So that's our lineup for this summer with the conference at Concordia St. Paul, June 10 and 11, a Friday night and Saturday morning and afternoon schedule for people who have jobs during the week and would like to not have to miss a day or two of work in order to attend the conference. We put it to the weekend.
Very convenient and helpful. Now, it's at Concordia University in St. Paul, Minnesota this year, correct?
That's correct.
How do we register? How can we get involved in this year's conference?
Probably the simplest way to register is with an online registration form that we have on our website. Our website is societyofcreation.org. So Society of Creation is one word, and .org. And so if you go there, then across the top of the page, there will be several different links, one of which is our charter that explains where we stand. And it's standing with the historic position of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, where we as a denomination have always been. Then the second link to the right of charter is conferences. And so if you scroll down a little bit on that conferences link, it gives, first of all, the title of our conference, and then there's a place to link or to click a link that will allow you to register online. And simply go to that link, click on it, and follow the instructions there. It can include payment right there with online registration, and attend as a result of that registration. There's more information about the conference itself, abstracts of the two plenary addresses of each of our keynote speakers. There's a printed home registration form, so if people prefer to register by sending us a check, they can do that. So they can click on that link and download it, print it, and then complete it and mail it in. There's also some, there's a conference schedule, plus there are four sample church bulletin announcements that if churches, pastors wanted to run some information in their church bulletins, there are four that I've written and uploaded to our website that can give information to their parishioners about attending the conference.
The you mentioned earlier that the conference will also be viewed on several of the Concordia University campuses. Who will be watching the cast from the viewing at those campuses?
Well, various people who live locally who want to attend it. It won't be two-way communication, although people at the remote campuses, I'll be hosting the one here in Austin, Texas, but people on this campus that are watching the presentations from St. Paul, Minnesota, will be able to text questions to the speakers at the end of their presentations and have those questions answered. But it will be one-way live streaming, and then the response is possible through texting back to an individual at Concordia St. Paul. So there will be probably a classroom in each of the three campuses in Mequon, Ann Arbor, and Austin that will be set up for the live streaming, and then people that come and attend at a significantly reduced cost will be able to benefit from the conference presentations there in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Well, great. So they can attend at St. Paul and the other campuses, Concordia University in Wisconsin, Concordia Ann Arbor in Michigan, and Concordia, Texas, there in Austin, can participate as well. They can listen, and then, as you said, can text in their questions at the end of the presentations. That's outstanding. Isn't it amazing how technology has allowed us to offer education and opportunities like this?
I think so. That's really exciting. We're ramping it up a little bit every year. The first 2 years were just live and face-to-face. The next year, the third year, was streaming from one campus to another, and this year it's streaming from one campus to three campuses. We're not sure where things are going to go next year. We've talked about holding one of our future conferences at the Creation Museum just outside of Cincinnati in northern Kentucky. So we may pursue that as a possibility and hold the conference there and see if we can stream it live to various Concordia universities, any university in the system that would be willing to receive that signal. So we'll see how that goes in the planning.
It is a great place to visit. Had the opportunity to do that this past fall with the Lutherans for Life conference, and that would be highly convenient for Dr. Menten, I suppose.
I think so. Yes, he does have a working relationship with Answers in Genesis. So I think he's still living in St. Louis, so I'm not sure, but he's working with Answers in Genesis, which is the ministry that operates the Creation Museum. And Dr. Robert Carter works with Creation Ministries International, which is an Atlanta, Georgia-based organization that does many of the same things, so they complement one another, supplement one another in their various creation ministries. A lot of people don't really know that the best scientific information about the age of the earth and the origins of the universe, the origin of mankind, comes from the creationist perspective, and there have been all kinds of predictions like the one I referenced earlier about the functionality of our DNA that have been made by creationist people and have been vindicated. And so often the predictions or assumptions of Darwinian evolution are shown to be false. Some of them, the carbon-14 dating, which has turned out now to be a friend of the young earth position, we discovered based upon secular research. Not that I'm doing that kind of research, but creationists discovered more than a decade ago that coal samples from Penn State University Coal Bank have shown significant amounts of carbon-14 to be resident in coal, and those coal samples were supposed to be a minimum of 30 million years old and a maximum of perhaps 300 million years old, and every single one of those coal samples, when they were tested, were shown to have significant amounts of carbon-14, consistent with an age that's in the thousands of years rather than the millions or hundreds of millions of years. And likewise, carbon-14 testing of diamond samples has shown the same thing, that diamonds are supposed to be 1 to 3 billion years old, and yet carbon-14 dating shows them to be in the thousands of years. But the secular academy doesn't really broadcast that information because it's really quite embarrassing to the positions that they hold.
What are you looking forward to most about this summer's conference?
Well, we're hoping to build some additional momentum. As we've gotten the word out, we've attempted to reach a larger and larger audience. So when we started, there were a few dozen members of the Society of Creation. Now we're over 150. We're trying to expand our reach and let other people throughout our church body and Christians in these four regions know about what we're doing. So we're trying to get the word out and build some momentum and hold up the biblical perspective on creationism, as well as some of the great literature, the presentations, the DVDs, the firsthand research that's being done, as well as many of the resources from the monthly magazines of CMI and Answers in Genesis to books and other research topics that are being offered by the various creation organizations. There's some really excellent material out there, and most people aren't aware of that because the secular media is dominated by a secularistic perspective, a Darwinian perspective, not even an old earth creationary perspective that believes the biblical theology, the biblical story, but thinks that operates with the same age of the earth that Darwinian evolution does. That position isn't even offered out there. So the secular academy has pretty well shut down the communication avenues of biblical Christians who are offering a very different perspective. And under the belief that knowing where we came from and who made us, who redeemed us, has a profound impact upon how we live our lives.
Absolutely. I'd like to revisit some of the details for the event this summer, just so our listeners can, if they want to find out more, how to register. It's coming up June 10th through the 11th, correct, at Concordia University, St. Paul?
That's correct.
And information is available on the website. And the website again?
www.societyofcreation.org, and click on the conferences link for an online registration process.
Very good. So you can register online, or you can find more information. I appreciate the information as well about each of the presenters and the presentations that they'll be covering. We're going to talk with them in just a little bit. We're going to talk with Dr. Robert Carter up next. He's senior scientist and speaker for Creation Ministries International. Anything specific you want to say about Dr. Carter before we wrap up our conversation today?
I've heard him speak. He's an engaging speaker. I think it's important not only to be a first-rate scientist, which he is, but also to be an effective presenter. And so I think that people that sometimes think that some of this technical and detailed research that scientists are doing is going to be incomprehensible to the listener, and that's definitely not the case with Dr. Carter or Dr. Menton.
Dr. Robert Carter up next. Dr. David Menton will talk with in just about 15 minutes as well, both presenters at the Society of Creation Conference. Our guest today, the Reverend Dr. Joel Heck, professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, and co-founder of the Society of Creation. Dr. Heck, thanks for being our guest on Faith and Family today.
You're very welcome.
Coming up in just a little bit, more Faith and Family. We'll talk with the presenters of the Society of Creation Conference for the summer. You're listening to Worldwide KFUO.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of inspiration in action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
You're listening to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. We're talking about the upcoming Society of Creation Conference this summer, June 10th and 11th at Concordia University, St. Paul. And our next guest, one of the presenters at the conference this summer, Dr. Robert Carter, Senior Scientist and Speaker for Creation Ministries International. Dr. Carter holds a PhD in marine biology with a focus in genetics. Dr. Carter, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thanks, Andy. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you with us today. Looking forward to learning more about what you're covering at the conference this summer. It sounds like an exciting conference, great topics, and just an engaging conference all around. Tell us a little bit about what prompted you to study marine biology and specifically genetics in marine biology.
Well, I started off in marine biology in general just because I was fascinated with the ocean and all the amazing questions that we have that no one knew answers to. But I ended up in the genetics laboratory studying a particular protein family in Caribbean corals. And I just used that to launch into a study of human genetics after I was finished. I've been studying the human genome for about 12 or 13 years now.
And so at the conference this summer, you have two presentations. First one on non-mythical Adam and Eve. Dr. Carter, what do we know about Adam and Eve? And we'll get to some misconceptions here in just a little bit. What do we already know about Adam and Eve?
Well, we already know that there was an Adam and that there was an Eve. The evolutionary community wants to obfuscate as much as they possibly can and say, oh, well, they never knew each other. They lived at different periods of time. They came from Africa. And I'm going to address each one of those claims and show that actually the biblical data stands very, very strong. The biblical predictions stand very strong compared to the genetic data. It is clear that there's only one human ancestor for all men in the world, and that is the direct biblical prediction, and that's exactly what evolutionary scientists have discovered. Same
what?
Goes for Eve. There's only one female ancestor of all the women in the world. We know her sequence. They think they know when she lived, but they throw in all these assumptions behind their dating techniques that I'll also address. I think their assumptions are incorrect.
What are, speaking of assumptions, what are misconceptions or incorrect assumptions about Adam and Eve that that you might be addressing in your presentation?
Well, one of the things they do, and it's actually pretty brilliant on their part, is they take the human genome and compare it to the chimpanzee genome, and you know there are millions of differences, and they say, well, of course we have millions of differences, but we have millions of years to accumulate all these differences, and the rate of change is really slow. Well, that means when you compare all the people in the world and you look at their differences, if you assume a really slow rate of change, it would take hundreds of thousands of years to produce the number of differences we see. And, of course, that's older than the Earth is, according to the Bible. But if we actually don't take the assumption of common ancestry with chimpanzees, if we just look at a family, some extended family, and you look at the people in that family, and you count up the number of differences, and you divide by the generations, you get a rate that's much, much, much higher. So the measurable rate, the true rate, the real rate, is orders of magnitude greater than the evolutionary rate, which is based on an assumption. And if we apply the real mutation rate to the data, it does not take hundreds of thousands of years to explain people. We can explain the differences from one end of this planet to the other of all the people in a few thousand years with room to spare.
Why is this not understood? Why is there a misconception about this, in your opinion?
Some of it because there's some specialist information, and so only a few people are studying some of this. Some of it is because the evolutionary community pretty much owns the most of the major publishing companies and newspapers and websites and things like that. So it's hard for a lot of people to find the information. And a lot of it, some of it also is because people are just afraid to ask the questions. you know, it looks so daunting when you read National Geographic or you watch the Discovery Channel. I mean, everything is evolution is true, evolution is true, evolution is true. And if that's all you ever hear, mm-hmm. it's really hard to say, wait a minute, it's not true because of this, because people don't know the this part. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay.
What about the other topic you're presenting on, the high-tech genome? What do we know about the genome? We're talking about the human genome, right?
The human genome. We can use any genome. Even a, mm-hmm. a simple bacterial genome would be so complicated it's hard to understand. But the human genome, I'm going to claim here that in order to understand the genome, we have to compare the way it works to the way a computer works. And I'm going to claim that the genome is the most complex computer operating system in the universe. And the reason we don't understand how it works is because we're not as smart as God, the ultimate computer programmer. And it is so incredibly complex that every little bit of information we learn about it now is actually arguing against evolutionary theory. Because evolution might work if life is simple. And that's the key. That's a huge key. If life is really, really, really simple, yeah, you know what? It might be able to change. But the more complex life becomes, the less possible evolution is.
Can you give us...
The human genome is the greatest counterexample to evolutionary theory that we've ever discovered.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. You know how in mathematics you learned that that a one-dimensional object is a line. It just has length only. And a two-dimensional object would be like a square. It has length and width. And a three-dimensional object is a cube. It has length, width, and height. Well, I'm going to say that the human genome is actually a four-dimensional computer program where we have a line. We have DNA. It's just a string. But programmed into that string is a giant two-dimensional interaction network where this piece of DNA makes a protein and comes over to here and sticks to another piece of DNA. And that does something else. So in order to draw those interactions, you'd have to write the DNA out in lines and draw arrows all over the place for all those interactions. But then that folds up into a three-dimensional ball. And whoever programmed the DNA knew that when it folded up into a three-dimensional ball, which pieces of DNA will be on the outside of the ball, therefore usable, and which pieces will be on the inside, therefore unusable. But not only that, the ball changes shape over time because different genes are needed at different periods during life. And so, you know, if you eat something like that's poisonous, your liver will say, hey, I can get rid of that poison. And it'll take its ball of DNA inside all the cells and morph the shape of it to expose different genes, make a bunch of proteins, and then put it back the way it was again. So it's literally, it's a four-dimensional shape that is so mind-bogglingly complex that everything we know about it argues against evolutionary theory.
What do you believe we have yet to learn about the genome?
There are still some fundamental things that we do not know. We do not know... we know that a piece of DNA can make a protein. We know that a lot of those proteins will interact with other pieces of DNA, and we're figuring that out. But, oh boy, how do you asked me almost an unanswerable question. I mean, what do we not know? I mean, some of the stuff we don't know, so I can imagine what we don't know, but I don't actually know what we don't know because we haven't learned it yet.
Let me rephrase that. What do you hope we may learn about the genome in the not-so-distant future? Does that help?
Yes. Based on what we already know, I am assuming and I am hoping that our understanding of the complexity of the genome is only going to go up. And I am hoping that enough scientists will realize the mathematics of the situation shows that Darwinian evolutionary theory is not possible. We already know enough. And all we're going to do in the future, as far as I know, is fill in the blanks, you know, more detail, more precision. We're going to unfold more complex things that happen in the genome that we don't know yet, but are just staring us in the face until someone finds them. But what I'm hoping is that that data will convince a lot of people that Darwin was flat out wrong.
What are you looking forward to about the Society of Creation Conference this summer, Dr. Carter?
Actually, most thing I'm looking forward to is the fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to people, encouraging people, being encouraged by other people. Someone's going to come up to me and say, hey, I got an idea, and we're going to sit down and talk over a cup of coffee for 2 hours about some new idea that none of us had thought of before. And that kind of interaction, I crave that.
Why is that fellowship important to a scientist? Why is that important to you and your work?
Well, think about, I'm in a minority, right? I'm a young Earth creations PhD. That puts me in a great minority. And so when I'm around other scientists or science-y type of people who like conversing and interacting and discussing ideas, it's a wonderful time of fellowship, companionship, edification, just to let you know that you're not alone. There are other people out there, and you got friends out there who are willing to work with you, things like that. And it's just, I like people.
Coming from the perspective, the worldview that you hold and that other creation science scientists hold, sometimes can be a rather isolated place in that field.
Oh, yeah. Especially for the younger people who are actually in graduate school or even undergraduate right now, a lot of them don't know that there's other people out there. And so many people, they just got their head down. They're just, they're tucked into a fetal position trying to survive, and they're not sticking their neck out, and they're just trying to go through it. And there are other people around them. They don't even know the other people. I was in my last year of graduate school, before I learned that another graduate student that I was going to school with agreed with me on this creation thing. And we just kind of looked at each other, said one or two sentences, we agree, and then we didn't say anything else after that. That was enough. He's cool, I'm cool, and I had a friend. That's all I knew.
Well, I'm glad that there will be an opportunity for fellowship at the conference this summer. So glad that you're presenting, and so much we can learn about the non-mythical Adam and Eve and the high-tech genome as well. The non-mythical Adam and Eve, that name just strikes me as interesting. I guess it's important that we distinguish between the true Adam and Eve and those fictitious characters that have been, fabricated through various theories about creation.
Yeah, but also so many people think the Bible is just mythology. Mm-hmm. That, the first couple of chapters of the Bible are just nonsense. There's no history there at all. And I'm just going to say that this is not true, and here's the information. How much data do you need before you'll can convince yourself that actually the Bible is a book of history? I mean, the Bible makes some very specific claims about human genetics. It claims we all came from an Adam, and it claims we all came from an Eve. It claims we all came from Noah. It claims there's been one dispersal of people across the planet from some central place. The evolutionists have discovered all that information, and then they put a spin on it, trying to make it sound evolutionary when it's really not.
Absolutely. Dr. Robert Carter, senior scientist and speaker for Creation Ministries International, and Dr. Carter holds a PhD in marine biology with a focus on genetics and will be presenting at the Society of Creation Conference this June 10th and 11th. Dr. Carter, thanks for being our guest today on Faith and Family.
You're welcome.
Coming up in just a little bit, we'll speak with another presenter for the Society of Creation this summer, Dr. David Menton, biologist, anatomist, speaker, author, and researcher with Answers in Genesis. We'll talk with him in just a little bit. You're listening to Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO.
God's word is our great heritage and shall be ours forever. To spread its light from age to age shall be our chief endeavor. I'm William Whedon, LCMS Director of Worship, inviting you to be sure and join us as we romp through chapter after chapter of the Sacred Scriptures, rejoicing in the salvation that's ours in Jesus Christ. Join us.
Thy Strong Word, weekday mornings at 11 on Worldwide KFUO. Underwritten by Lutheran Heritage Foundation. LHFmissions.org. Worldwide KFUO, your most trusted radio station for Christian talk and sacred music. Listen on the air, online, and on demand 24 hours a day at KFUO.org. Listen anywhere you are with your Wi-Fi radios, smartphones, computers, and even on your smart TVs. KFUO embracing today's technologies to bring the good news message of Christ to the world. Listener-supported Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
If you have a question about the LCMS, contact the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Church Information Center, and you'll be connected with a real person who can help you find the answer. Call 1-888-THE-LCMS or 1-888-843-5267 or email them infocenter@lcms.org. Helping you with your questions and finding you resources, the LCMS Church Information Center.
Worldwide KFUO has been listener-supported since 1924, teaching the good news of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection for our sins, and witnessing to the world about God's mercy. We are on AM 850 in St. Louis, and a click away 24 hours a day at kfuo.org. If you have questions about donating, you can email us, gifts@kfuo.org.
You're listening to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. Joining me by phone now, Dr. David Menten, biologist, anatomist, speaker, author, and researcher with Answers in Genesis, also a former professor at Washington University School of Medicine here in St. Louis. Dr. Menten holds a PhD in cell biology. Dr. Menten, welcome to Faith and Family.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Glad to have a chance to talk with you today about the upcoming Society of Creation Conference. Dr. Menten, tell us a little bit about what led you to your many vocations in your profession. You're a biologist, anatomist, speaker, author, researcher. You were a professor at Washington University School of Medicine. What led you to study in this field of cell biology?
Well, I guess I grew up as one of those nerdy science kids, you know, the lab in the basement, you know the type. And I guess from the time I was a child, I wanted to be a scientist. That was it. So that's what I did. I really enjoy looking at God's thoughts after him in the natural world.
And as you were entering in this field of study in science, you're also a Lutheran, correct?
Yeah, lifelong, baptized about 2 months old.
Did you ever
wasted the first 2 months of my life?
did you ever find it challenging as you were studying science and also being a confessing Christian? You know, that with what God's Word says about creation and what you might find in the science classroom or in the lab?
Oh, my. You know, the evidence for God's handiwork in nature is so absolutely overwhelming. And the evolutionary explanation for any integrated complexity of our body is so inadequate that evolution has quite simply never been a challenge to me. I can't really understand why people, particularly some theologians, would ever buy into it. It simply has no real explanatory power. It's a scenario, a story.
Well, the topics for that you're addressing in your presentations this summer at the Society of Creation Conference, the first one, three ways to make an ape man. have you made an ape man before?
No, in fact, I have two titles for the talk, and they sound contradictory. First, God didn't make any ape men, and the subtitle is Three Ways to Make an Ape Man. I believe that God didn't make ape men. Psalm 100, verse 3 says, "Know that the Lord, He is God, it is He who has made us, not we ourselves. We are His people and the sheep of His pasture." So we're accountable to Him.
And Jesus certainly taught the creation of man as well. In Matthew 19, he said, "Have you not read, he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and the two become one flesh." And the evolutionary view, of course, it not only undermines the whole idea of creation, but in this case, undermines the whole concept of marriage and makes it nothing more than a tradition. And I think if society ever gets to the point where we really buy totally into the evolutionary view, we won't know what marriage is anymore. Wait a minute. We're already there, aren't we?
Absolutely. Right. We've lost touch with what is marriage. And in a sense, I think we've lost touch with what it means to be human.
Absolutely.
Even. You know, I talk with Dr. Bob Weiss on Mondays on his time, and that's the very question that comes up every week. What does it mean to be human? And I'm not sure we really understand what that means anymore.
Well, that's one of the things we'll be doing in going through this talk. I believe there are three ways by which evolutionists come up with the concept of an ape man. And I can't think of a fourth possibility myself. Since God didn't make ape men, there are no ape men out there. There are apes in the fossil record. There are humans in the fossil record. They're both very rare. In fact, bony creatures make up the tiniest fraction of a tenth of a percent of all fossils. But there is evidence. There are skeletons out there of primates, and both human and ape. And when we look at this evidence, if we don't begin with the assumption that man has in fact evolved from ape-like creatures, then the evidence is not compelling. But the evolutionist really begins with the starting assumption that's unquestioned, that man has evolved from lower forms of life, most recently an ape-like creature. It would be career-ending to even question that. So when evolutionists look at the fossil record, they see the apes, they see the humans. They're simply asking which of these apes became human. But what they do then is they take apes, like the Australopithecines, of which Lucy is a famous example, and they try to upscale, find something about this ape that smacks of something that could be thought of as human. Then they find humans in the fossil record, like Cro-Magnon man, Neanderthal man. Most of the creatures that are put together under the term Homo really are human. And there they try to do the opposite, try to find something, say, about Neanderthal man that we can push him down. Sure, he looks human, but there's this. He has this brow ridge. It's fairly pronounced in the adults, at least. Somewhat different dimensions on the pelvis than would be average for today. Try to do something to push this individual down. And then the third way to make an ape man is to find ape fossils one place, find human fossils perhaps another, combine the two together, declare them to be one specimen. Now, that could be intentional, as it was with Piltdown Man. That was an intentional hoax where orangutan bones, modern orangutan, was combined with human and fooled evolutionists for 40 years into thinking that it was an ape man. And, of course, it could be unintentional, too, where you get parts from two different specimens, and one could be human, one ape, and then you would get a combination look. So those are the three ways: upscale an ape, downscale a human, and combine parts of both.
It seems that quite frequently, maybe every week, every month, there's a newly discovered missing link. What are the most current missing links, and how do we respond to those? Missing link in terms of the origin of man.
Was it Lewis or Chesterton that said, we seem to know everything about the missing link except that it is missing? always a missing link. Actually, we have a missing chain out there. When you look at these trees of life, like right now the Smithsonian is sponsoring this big program that's going around to libraries all over the country, and they show this tree, and there's different clusters of branches, and the Ardipithecus group, which is supposed to be 4 to 6 million years old, is on one branch, and then Paranthropus is on another. Australopithecines are on yet another, and finally you've got humans. But the only evolutions in the drawing of the tree, the branching of the tree, which is an artistic rendition, when you look at the specimens themselves, they're just simply sitting there on the tree, and there's no evidence that any one of them has evolved into another. In fact, I can say quite confidently we do not have any evidence whatever that would clearly and specifically show how any one creature changed into another of a different kind.
The other topic you're presenting on at the conference this summer, beauty is skin deep. Now, that's kind of different than what we usually hear. We usually hear, well, beauty is more than skin deep.
Right. I meant to be provocative with that title. I guess what I'm really saying is that beauty is also skin deep. I happen to spend a good part of my career starting at Mayo Clinic many years ago, working in the Department of Dermatology and research there. When I was at Brown University, I got my PhD, and the research was on skin, the water barrier of skin. And so I have a real considered interest in that field, and it's such a remarkable organ. It's right out there where we can all see it. It resists our best efforts to improve it when we put tattoos on it and run rings through it, do all sorts of other insults to the skin. And I'll touch on things that a lot of people never heard of. For example, you know, the skin of our face. Realize there's over 40 muscles in our face that pull the skin around and produce facial expressions, and these facial expressions are understood all over the world. Any culture, even if they've never seen people outside of their own culture, a smile's a smile, a frown's a frown, anger's anger. There are even micro-expressions that last for less than 0.2 seconds that can reveal our real view of something rather than the face we're trying to put on. There can be 20 or more muscles that are necessary to give a really genuine smile. Then we'll talk about how the skin is woven like a fabric. In fact, the whole field of study through the microscope is called histology. It comes from a Greek word, histos, means a web or a fabric. And so looking through the microscope there at Washington University School of Medicine, I taught histology, the study of woven things, and we looked at skin, too, among other things. We're so woven, you'd almost think we were knit together in our mother's womb. That's just how woven we are. So anyway, the fibers of our dermis, which would be like the leather, is just exquisitely woven. But unlike a fabric that a human makes, the warp and the woof, the grain of the fabric is the same over the entire piece of fabric. But when God weaves our skin, the weave is different over our elbow or over our back or on our abdomen or chest. It varies so that the mechanical properties are optimized for how we're going to use each area. I always tell people, how's dumb luck working for you when you look at something like that?
Well, Dr. Menton, we are all out of time, but if we want to hear more, I guess we need to make it to the Society of Creation conference this summer, June 10th and 11th. Dr. David Menton, biologist, anatomist, speaker, author, and researcher with Answers in Genesis, former professor at Washington University School of Medicine here in St. Louis. Dr. Menton, thanks for being our guest today on Faith and Family.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up in just a little bit, Thy Strong Word. You're listening to Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.